What do you think the history books will say? Will say about the January 6th attack when Trump loyalists stormed the Capitol attempting to stop the electoral vote count? We're looking back on history and on the greatest crisis in American history, the Civil War, to inform where we are as a nation today. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Never before had a mob of insurrectionists attempted to overturn the vote, overturn the presidential election. Images from that day show attackers flying the Confederate battle flag inside the nation's capital. What lessons do you think we should take away? 800-642-1234. Eric Foner is an emeritus professor of history at Columbia University and one of the nation's leading Civil War historians, written dozens of books, including his latest. It's called The Second Founding: How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Very happy to be here, Kate.
You've been asked this question a lot by now, but what did you think of January 6th?
Well, I wasn't totally surprised. I was surprised that there was so little security around the Capitol, since it seemed fairly obvious that people who were strong followers of President Trump might be doing something to try to disrupt the electoral count. But once it started, of course, I was just shocked, like many people. We have not seen events like that at the Capitol in our history. Maybe we have to go back to when the British burned the Washington in 1814. But on the other hand, as a historian looking back over our history in general, it struck me that, things like this have happened, particularly in the era that I studied, the Civil War and Reconstruction. In Reconstruction, after the Civil War, you had a number of cases where armed mobs of white people overturned duly elected governments. They killed numerous African-American militiamen, office holders. There's the Colfax Massacre in Louisiana when this happened, 1873, or go forward, Wilmington, North Carolina, 1898, a biracial, democratically elected government was ousted by a white mob and basically a coup d'etat. The officials were driven out of town and new ones just took over. So the idea of violence to overturn an election is not totally new at all in our history, even though it hadn't happened in terms of a presidential election before.
What about the Confederate battle flag being flown inside our nation's capital?
You know, we forget the fact, I think that very day, January 6th, not only did you have this event in the riot, but you also had the Mississippi legislature approving a new state flag, which removes the Confederate battle flag insignia from the Mississippi's flag. That was a step forward. The fact that in Washington you still have people displaying the Confederate battle flag shows you what their views are. You know, this is not just heritage. It's not just standing up to authority. It's the flag of treason. It's the flag of racism. It's the flag of slavery. And, as scholars of the Civil War, we often say the Civil War isn't quite over yet. And maybe that's what displaying the Confederate flag is telling us.
Yeah, I mean, this is very recent history, recent events, because, I lived in Louisiana many years. A Confederate flag flew above the parish courthouse in Caddo Parish in Shreveport until November 4th, 2011. That is very recent history when it was finally taken down. Monuments, though, a very different story. How do we repair the harm?
Well, the nation did have reconciliation after the Civil War, after Reconstruction. It took a good while. I mean, let's start by saying I don't think we're on the eve of another violent civil war at the moment. We are deeply polarized, but politically, but I don't see armies quite yet marching to battle. But nonetheless, we can learn some lessons. I mean, to me, the lesson of the war, Reconstruction, and then reconciliation later is that you have to make sure that reconciliation comes along with justice, comes along with accountability. You know, the reconciliation we had, let's say, around the 1890s, early 20th century, was between white Northerners and white Southerners. And one of the elements of that was, first of all, ignoring the role of slavery in the Civil War. It became a battle over states' rights. It became a battle over local control. Slavery was sort of pushed to the side. And second of all, the rights that African Americans had gained right after the Civil War during Reconstruction, the right to vote, hold office, etc., civil rights, were stripped away. In other words, black people were the victims of white reconciliation around 1900, that period. And we don't want, President Biden correctly talks about unity, moving forward, very important, but you don't want to do that while sacrificing the rights of some groups of Americans.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with history professor Eric Foner about the deep division in our country as we see in our nation today, tracing that back to tensions between the North and the South over slavery, over the states' rights, 160 years ago, Civil War history. You can join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Mike is joining us from Spooner this morning. Hi, Mike. What would you like to say?
Say that the Confederate flag is not always necessarily a form of racism. And I do agree, yes, the KKK and disgusting groups that were started by the Democrats often wave that flag, and I do not condone it. And if you don't want people storming your building, you probably shouldn't steal an election either. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Mike's saying there is hard to understand, saying that the Confederate flag doesn't signify racism and slavery.
Depends on who is displaying it, where, and what circumstance. You mentioned a minute ago, Kate, the flag over the state, over the county courthouse. That's a statement of who's in power in that county. It's not just a kind of a historical memo. If someone has a Confederate flag on in their backyard, you know, that's one thing. But when it's displayed publicly by the powers that be, it's telling something to everybody. You know, my wife and I have a little house in northwestern Connecticut in the Litchfield Hills. We were not part of the Confederacy up there. And there are people who have a little decal of a Confederate flag on their pickup truck or something. I'm sure they're not putting it up there for racism. But on the other hand, you have to realize that many people take it that way. It would be as if you put a little Nazi insignia on your car and said, well, really, this has nothing to do with Hitler, but I just kind of like that symbol. You know, it's interesting with the different arms going different ways, so I put it out there. But you have to be cognizant of how these symbols, what they tell other people. And now the Confederate flag represents slavery, racism, I'm sorry. And by the way, that's what it did then. If you don't think it represents slavery, read Alexander Stevens's, the vice president of the Confederacy's, cornerstone speech when the South was seceding. He said the cornerstone of the Confederacy is racism, that is the idea that white people are superior to blacks and that the natural condition of black people is slavery. If you don't call that racism, what do you call it?
American historian Eric Foner, our guide to what history says about January 6th. Does the Civil War feel like an appropriate reference point right now? When you look back to Reconstruction, what is the cost? What is the cost of reconciliation and justice and the lasting effects that slavery had on our nation to present day? Is our nation capable of healing and unity? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Eric Foner here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What a privilege to spend the hour with American historian Eric Foner, author of dozens of books, Pulitzer Prize winner of history. He's giving us this historical framework for trying to understand the efforts to undermine democratic ideals, trying to understand the realities of white supremacy embedded in our nation as we look at January 6th. Are you worried that our country's cultural divisions will lead to more violence or even secession and civil strife? What questions do you have? 800-642-1234. And Columbia University historian Eric Foner stays with us. Let's bring in Tanya now, joining us from Milwaukee. Tanya, hi, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, with the polarization of our essentially two-party system, how does that play into all this unrest and everything compared to the Civil War with the North and the South?
Well, as I said before, I don't think we've reached the level of polarization of, let's say, the 1850s and then the secession crisis. Although, you know, this kind of violence that we saw at the Capitol is worrisome. If you go back to the decade before the Civil War, the 1850s, you see an escalating acceptance of violence. You see by all sorts of groups in society, you see abolitionists violently resisting the enforcement of the fugitive slave law, rescuing fugitive slaves who had been captured to be sent back to the South. You had Bleeding Kansas in the mid-1850s, where pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers in Kansas were engaged in battle. You had John Brown's raid in 1859, where Brown and a small band invaded Virginia to try to set off a slave insurrection. These events build on each other. They make violence more plausible. They make violence more acceptable. I'm not saying they immediately created the Civil War, but people were more willing to march off to battle at the end of the 1850s than they had been at the beginning of the 1850s. By the way, I forgot to mention, in the Capitol itself, Senator Charles Sumner, the abolitionist from Massachusetts, was assaulted by a representative, Brooks, from South Carolina. So you had violence inside the chamber of the Senate itself. We haven't quite had that, although I suppose it's a parallel to some of the things that happened in the Capitol a couple of weeks ago. So acceptance of violence, the idea that violence is a legitimate way of expressing your views and combating those you don't like politically, that's a dangerous thing to get embedded in our political culture.
Let's unpack Reconstruction just a bit more here. You've estimated about 2,000 African Americans held public office during Reconstruction, and that with Black congressmen, we were moving toward an interracial democracy, or we had perhaps even achieved an interracial democracy. What was happening, and what got us off track?
Well, Reconstruction does have lessons for the present, and one of them is, you know, we're still debating the issues of Reconstruction. Who should be a citizen? Who should have the right to vote? How do you deal with domestic terrorism? I mean, you had, you know, as you said, after the Civil War, in a series of laws and constitutional amendments, African Americans were declared citizens. Remember, the Dred Scott decision before the Civil War had said only white people could be citizens of the United States. Men were given the right to vote, Black men. Women, of course, couldn't vote anywhere at that moment. And you had these biracial democratic governments set up in the South. It was a remarkable thing in a society that had known slavery only a few years before. You had African-American men sitting in legislatures, holding local offices, justices of the peace, school board officials, in Congress, etc. This was a radical change in our politics. But there were many people who could not accept it. There was considerable violence. You had, I mentioned before, these mob efforts to overthrow some of these biracial governments. And eventually, Reconstruction was overturned, really, by the late 1870s and 1880s. So, you know, the idea that elections in which Black people are taking part are fraudulent was not invented in the last, in the last few months. White Democrats back then, the Democratic Party at that time was the party of white supremacy. The Republicans were the party of Lincoln, of emancipation, of Reconstruction. White supremacist Democrats just did not accept the legitimacy of African Americans as equal citizens. And if you have that attitude, it's going to be hard to have unity and reconciliation. And I think you hear echoes of that a little bit in the battle over the last presidential election. After all, what were the, what do the places have in common that the former president's groups, lawyers tried to challenge the vote coming out of there? Milwaukee, of course, in Wisconsin, Philadelphia. What do those places have in common? That they have a lot of Black voters. They weren't challenging the vote in these white, rural counties. So, you know, there was a sort of intimation that somehow black voting leads to corruption, it's fraud, it doesn't quite, you know, measure up to democratic processes. And that was a widely held view, unfortunately, in Reconstruction also.
We're talking with Columbia history professor Eric Foner, author of dozens of history titles, asking what history will make of January 6th in light of what our nation has gone through. 800-642-1234 to join in. Laura is with us from Wausau. Hi, Laura. What would you like to ask?
Yes, hello. A very good segue. I have a question in regards to the election, the recent election. In American history, has there ever been an election like we just had where a very good chunk of the American voters actually felt that the election was stolen, even though I believe that's erroneous? But have we ever had an election that there was such a strong belief that somebody stole it? And because I believe that that's a big catalyst for what occurred on January 6th?
Well, yes. The answer is yes. I can't go through all the elections, but let's say in 1824, Andrew Jackson, who had come out ahead in the popular, no, not ahead, he'll come out second in the, no, let me start again. Andrew Jackson came in first in the popular vote and in the electoral vote, but didn't get a majority. And the House chose John Quincy Adams, even though he had come in second. And the Jackson people said, this is fraud. It's what they call the corrupt bargain. And they spent the next 4 years waiting to overturn Adams, which Jackson did in 1828. Obviously, the Lincoln's election, it wasn't exactly called fraudulent, but large parts of the South said, we do not accept this. I'm sorry, we are not going to stay in this nation under the presidency of a man who is opposed to slavery. They didn't claim that the votes had been miscounted, but they just said, we are not accepting the result of this election. I'm sorry. And that, of course, triggers the Civil War. One other one, 1876, the so-called disputed election, where there were conflicting returns from three states. It was not clear who had carried them, and whoever won those three states would win the Electoral College, Hayes, the Republican, or Tilden, the Democrat. And in fact, that was, you know, that election was put forward by Ted Cruz in the Senate as a model for what should be done now. There was an electoral commission that basically decided who had won the electoral vote. And Cruz said, why don't we have an electoral commission now? It was interesting because then Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, you know, in the debates on the night after the rioting, he said, well, you know, the problem is the commission and the bargain in 1877 led to the end of Reconstruction and the beginning of the Jim Crow system, and that was a bad thing. As a historian, I found that really interesting because for so many years, Reconstruction's been considered a terrible, you know, mistake. Now Lindsey Graham is saying it's really unfortunate that Reconstruction was overturned.
10 African Americans have served in the U.S. Senate. Reverend Raphael Warnock, who won the runoff in Georgia, becomes the 11th Black U.S. Senator in history, only the second one from the South since Reconstruction. What do you think of that?
Well, the first two Black U.S. senators were from Reconstruction, from Mississippi, Hiram Revels and Blanche K. Bruce. The next Black senator, you had to wait a long time, and that would be Edward Brooke from Massachusetts in the 1950s, 80 years later. Recently, there have been more, obviously, and today, for the first time, there are three African Americans in the U.S. Senate, Warnock and then Scott of South Carolina, who is the other one from a ex-Confederate state, and then Cory Booker, of course, from New Jersey. What does all this prove? What it proves is it's hard very often for African Americans to get elected where you have a white voting majority. Most of the people, Black people in Congress are members of the House, and they often represent Black majority districts or districts where Blacks are, 45% or something like that. It's harder for African Americans. They have done it, but it's harder for African Americans to win statewide elections. There have been very, very few black governors in American history. I'm not sure how many, but I don't think there have been more than four or five or six. There's still a reluctance on the part of some non-black voters to vote for a black candidate. Not all the time. President Obama was elected twice, so someone could point that out as a counterexample. But, you know, it's amazing. We've had one African-American president out of, what, 46? Mm. 11 out of 2,000 senators is not a very good number.
Eric Foner, a professor emeritus of history at Columbia University, our guide through a historical lens as we look at January 6th and look back at the moments in our racially fraught history. Is our nation committed to the democratic process? Can unity and reconciliation be achieved? And by whom? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with American historian Eric Foner after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at what history can tell us at this moment in our nation. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden, in his inaugural address, said we must end this uncivil war, and we can.
Here we stand in the shadow of the Capitol Dome, as was mentioned earlier, completed amid the Civil War, when the Union itself was literally hanging in the balance. Yet we endured. We prevailed.
Do you think our political divide is so deep that it draws comparisons to the Civil War? Are we capable of reunifying? What does that path look like to heal and reconcile? 800-642-1234. We have American historian, author of dozens of books, Eric Foner, as our guide, professor emeritus of history at Columbia. Let's bring in another call now. Delbert is with us from Rice Lake. Hi, Delbert.
Hello.
Hi, Delbert. Yes, go ahead. We can hear you.
Well, excuse me. I get that in my throat in this time of the year. But anyway, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm a constitutional conservative, and I hate liars with my passion. And I was listening to you make the statement that it was the Trump demonstrators that caused the riot, and it makes me think about when they were trying to recall Scott Walker here in Wisconsin, and they was hauling in demonstrators out by the busload to destroy our Capitol. And I think some of these people that make these statements should have to back it up with some facts. Where did these demonstrators come from, and who was paying them?
Okay, so Delbert is talking about when thousands of protesters rushed the Wisconsin Capitol in 2011 around Governor Scott Walker limiting collective bargaining rights for public workers. Eric,
yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, I remember that. Obviously, I am at a bit of a distance from Wisconsin here in New York City, so I'm not really qualified to speak directly on what happened in the state capital of Wisconsin then. I don't recall, maybe I'm wrong, that there were acts of violence. There were large numbers of people demonstrating. Were they trashing the offices of members of the legislature? Were people killed? Five people died on January 6th. But, you know, from whatever direction we're talking about, left, right, center, these kinds of, you know, disruptions are to be, you know, are not to be supported, especially when they're accompanied by violence. And that was the case on, you know, on January 6th. So we need to have maybe greater respect for the democratic process. You know, in this case, an election was held. Large numbers of people refused to accept the result of the election as being fair and honest. And when you develop that attitude, regardless of how much evidence there may be, there isn't really very much, I think you're undermining the democratic process, which is the essence of our political system, or should be, certainly.
President Biden, in his inaugural address, called for an end to an uncivil war, as he put it. His speech was peppered with references to the Civil War era. What struck you?
I noticed that definitely. I'm not sure what books President Biden has been reading. It's good to have a president who has a sense of history, a knowledge of the country's history. I have mixed feelings as a Civil War historian. I think that too many comparisons to the Civil War can lead to a sort of a exaggeration of the problem we face today. We are not on the eve of a violent clash, which, you know, the Civil War lasted 4 years and took over 700,000 lives, which if you multiply that in by the population today would be about 7 million Americans killed proportionately there. We're not on the eve of that. In fact, you know, I think the notion of polarization may have been somewhat exaggerated. If you look at public opinion polls on, you know, basic issues, you will find much more harmony than the heated rhetoric in Washington may suggest. I mean, take a simple thing like, should the government guarantee a job to everybody who wants one, who's unemployed? Like 70% of the population says yes. That's way beyond the polarization we normally feel. Or take another issue, minimum wage. Should the minimum wage be raised to $15? Well, in Florida, during the past election, they had a referendum on exactly that. And again, it passed by about 70% of the vote. This is a state that was carried by President Trump in the presidential election. So if you go to specific issues, you may find that there is less polarization than one may think by just listening to the heated rhetoric on Twitter or on, talk radio or TV, et cetera, which is constantly whipping up hostilities.
Well, this brings us, I think, to history lessons, how we teach our young people today. We heard from Carolina and Grafton and asking you, how should school districts teach about racial awareness, about inclusion? How should school districts teach about the Reconstruction era, which when you were in high school in the 50s is dramatically different than how Reconstruction era is taught today?
Oh, absolutely. Well, of course, as a history professor, I believe that studying history is a very desirable thing for students of all ages. And the biggest problem with history education right now is there isn't enough of it. Many states have cut back on history requirements in public middle schools, public high schools, including my state, New York. I'm not trying to suggest that we're doing everything right over here. We don't have enough history education in New York State high schools. That's partly because of the emphasis on the so-called STEM subjects, on math, on technology, et cetera, on getting a job with your high school or college degree. But yes, of course, we should teach about the history of our country is something to be very proud of. And yet, on the other hand, it has many things that one maybe shouldn't be proud of. And both of those have to be taught. The history of liberty, of democracy, and the history of slavery and racial inequality. These things go together in our history. It's not a question of saying it's good or bad, the whole history. It's teaching students the complications of how our rights have expanded over time and the resistance to the expansion of rights. There are always people who are going to see the expansion of the rights of some groups as somehow taking something away from them. And that is a very pernicious idea. It was around in Reconstruction when the Constitution was amended, when the laws were changed to give basic rights to African Americans. You know, President Andrew Johnson at that point, he vetoed these laws. They were passed over his veto. But he said, black people really aren't equipped to be citizens. In fact, these laws are giving all the advantage to blacks over whites. The idea that giving blacks their rights took something away from white people is ridiculous. But that idea was very prominent in Reconstruction in some circles, and you hear echoes of it today, I'm sorry to say. And I think a more complicated view of our history will help students kind of overcome kind of narrow-minded views like that.
Didn't Johnson, though, face quite a bit of opposition from the radical Republicans, who were a powerful anti-slavery faction within Congress at that time?
Well, the radical Republicans were a dynamic group They weren't a majority of Congress in the older views of Reconstruction, which I was taught in high school and many people were of that generation. The radicals were just vindictive. They didn't really care about the condition of the former slaves. They wanted to punish the South. Again, you see the idea. Giving something to African Americans is a punishment to white people. That's ridiculous. That doesn't take anything away from others, that now new groups have the right to vote and hold office, etc. The radicals used to be considered, as I say, fanatics, vindictives. Now they are considered precursors of the civil rights era of the 1960s. People like Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens, and others. They were the ones in Congress fighting for the rights of the former slaves. And their reputation in history has been elevated considerably since the days when I was in school.
We're talking with Eric Foner, who is one of our country's leading Civil War historians, and getting your thoughts as well. Let's bring in Jimmy now in Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Morning. Well, I just think that, you know, since the Civil War anyway, we've figured out that it's best to resolve issues through the political process, not violence. If you look at other countries like Afghanistan and Lebanon, they always seem to be in a state of civil war, and they can never establish a productive society. So I'm hopeful that if there's any good that comes out of this thing that happened at the Capitol, that people look at that and say, man, we got to step back. And if we lost an election, we just have to work harder the next time so we can get our policies in place. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks.
You know, I agree with what you said. Of course, the acceptance of the democratic process is essential to, you know, our political culture. And it will come. I think that many supporters for the former president were very unhappy that he lost, obviously, found it hard to accept. But I think in time, that sentiment will diminish. Maybe what will happen, as you said, that he or someone who shares his views will run again, and people will then have an opportunity to campaign and to vote. So I'm not so pessimistic to think that we are in a position where our democratic process is so damaged that it can never be repaired. I don't believe that at all.
What do you make of Biden's calls for unity in our country? Is unity achievable?
I think it's admirable to call for unity. I think I hope it's obtainable. It's not going to mean that Biden gets everything he wants from Congress, or that Congress blocks, I hope, everything, you know, that everything that he wants. I think unity is desirable, but it has to have some kind of substance. What are the issues on which unity can, you know, can take place, can be developed? We will see over the next couple of months. One thing I think history tells us, and you can go back to when FDR got into office, or even when President Obama was elected and took office, these were all in crises. We are in crises today, more than one. People want dramatic action. They are electing a president to do something. And I think President Biden is, well, he's only been in office one day, so we can't make conclusions. But, you know, people don't want the president to just sort of take his time. They want action on these crises.
Right.
If the
here,
president
right now,
takes dramatic action, he will get more unity than you might think.
Eric Foner, Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia, distinguished Civil War scholar. He's helping us better see the underlying fabric of our political civil strife, deep partisan divisions. What is at stake for our nation? How should President Biden heed Lincoln's first inaugural address with its appeal to the better angels of our nature? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about the historical echoes of this time we're living in. What a privilege to spend the hour with American historian Eric Foner, author of more than 20 books on history, professor emeritus at Columbia. Our nation has been through a civil war, a Great Depression. Now we face perhaps more threats than ever in our entire history. And Eric Foner stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Jesse now in Milwaukee with thoughts. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There's a couple of points. The insurrection on January 6th is like the Reichstag fire. It was a self-inflicted wound. If you look at what the Republicans wanted to do, they had large numbers who were going to challenge the electoral vote. And yet after the so-called insurrection, you only had a handful. So it didn't help the Republican movement to do that. 5 years of Trump rallies, and not one of them was violent. Second point is, if you want to look back at systemic racism, all you have to do is look at the 13th Amendment. And it states, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime, whereas the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So they took the slaves out of the fields and then criminalized them and then put them back in the fields. But it affected all Americans as well. That's just some of the points I wanted to make. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The 13th Amendment, this is part of my most recent book about the Reconstruction constitutional amendments. It had this terrible loophole allowing involuntary servitude as a punishment for crime. Now, the people who wrote the 13th Amendment did not envision the massive system of convict labor that would be put in place in the South after Reconstruction, 1880s, 1890s, a very oppressive system, whereas the gentleman just said, in many Southern states, the courts were used to sort of convict black people of trivial crimes, really, and then they would be jailed and then rented out to work on plantations or in lumber operations or factories, etc. One lesson of that is, if you are going to amend the Constitution, you better be very careful with the language that you are choosing. They didn't anticipate this, but it still became a major problem. You're absolutely right. You know, as to challenging the electoral vote, you know, my view, which is as a citizen, is that the Electoral College has long since become archaic and out of date and really ought to be ended or abolished, even though it seems unlikely that that will ever happen. You know, we have a situation in which the person who gets the most votes does not necessarily win the election. That has happened several times in the last, 20 years. And it's just not democratic. I'm sorry. I know that there are reasons why people oppose changing it, but the very fact that they were trying to count the electoral votes when this riot took place shows you that this, you know, is a sort of a symbol of the fact that the electoral vote itself is a kind of a strange relic of the 18th century, which we might very well think of getting rid of.
You talked there about the 13th Amendment. What about the 14th? Did that have more teeth to it, if you will, to get equality and civil legal rights for African Americans?
Well, the 14th is the most important amendment added to the Constitution since the Bill of Rights, and it's the longest amendment ever added, and it covers a wide variety of grounds. It first begins with what we call birthright citizenship. Anybody born in the United States is automatically a citizen, and that made black people citizens, where the Supreme Court before that had said they're not. And then it goes on to say that these citizens, and indeed any person, not just citizens, anyone within the United States is entitled to equal protection of the laws. It puts the concept of equality among Americans into the Constitution for the first time. There's nothing about race in that language. It applies to everybody. And the 14th Amendment in the 20th century has been, and the 21st has been used by the courts to expand the rights of all sorts of people. I mean, just not that long ago, the gay marriage decision. That's a 14th Amendment decision. Equality before the law. If you have laws allowing, straight couples to marry, then gay couples should also have the right to marry, or one man, one vote, or the right to privacy, or even go back Brown v. Board of Ed. All these are 14th Amendment decisions based on equal protection of the laws. So that's a, you know, wonderful sentiment. It didn't exist in our Constitution before the Reconstruction era. So it shows you how radical some of the changes were that were put into the Constitution and the laws in the aftermath of the Civil War.
Talking with Eric Foner, a professor emeritus of history at Columbia University. Let's bring in Daryl now in Germantown. Hi, Daryl. What would you like to share?
Well, I'd like to share my viewpoint about, there's a lot of discussion here going on about moving ahead from what happened at the insurrection at the Capitol last week. But what I feel needs to happen is that the people, especially the president that incited that riot, should all be held accountable with criminal charges and brought to justice. And without any kind of justice, we can't move forward in this country. There has to be accountability. And that's really lacking a lot in the political system right now.
Well, you know, I agree with your sentiment, and many countries have kind of grappled with this. In South Africa, as you may know, they established a Truth and Reconciliation Commission after the end of apartheid. They said, reconciliation is necessary, but with it must come a full accounting of what happened under apartheid. People who admitted or acknowledged what the crimes they had committed in enforcing the apartheid system were let off, in a sense, but you needed to actually explain what had happened. And some people say that wasn't enough accountability. But, I think whether individuals, people who committed acts of violence should be put on trial. I don't care if they did it in the Capitol or on a beach somewhere. That is just purely against the law and must be punished. Whether the president can be indicted for what happened as president, I leave to the constitutional lawyers to fight among themselves. Impeachment is the mode with which we try to have accountability for the president, but it's not 100% clear whether once he's out of office, he can also be impeached. But we may be facing that over the next month or so.
Eric, there have been calls for reparations, a formal public atonement for slavery in America, some kind of compensation for people whose ancestors were brutalized. How do you see this question?
You know, my view is that discussion of reparations is good in the sense that it makes people think about our history. And as a historian, I think that's salutary. Again, it's the question of truth and reconciliation. Personally, I think it's better to look forward. Let's accept the fact that the shadow of slavery and of Jim Crow still hangs over this country in many of the inequalities that we see and that have been highlighted in the last year or so. I like to look forward. What can we do? What social policies are needed to try to bridge that gap, to try to narrow the gap, to try to overcome the legacies of slavery and racism in this country? Whether you call it reparations or social policy doesn't matter to me. I think we do need a reckoning whereby we try to make sure that the wide gap between the races, in terms of, you name it, housing and healthcare and education, life expectancy, access to funds from banks, all that, and of course, police behavior, how we can address those inequalities. That's what I think we need to use history to help guide us in that way.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Eric Foner is a professor emeritus of history at Columbia University, one of the nation's leading Civil War historians. His most recent book is called The Second Founding: How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.